This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Donald Trump's Hope and Change. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Final weekend of May. Thanks for spending part of it with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
How the most diverse county in America abandoned its Democratic roots for Trump's message. It's considered one of nine influential counties around the country.
New trend for wedding season in the coming weeks. Brides getting rid of traditional bouquets. Hear what they're choosing instead.
Mold, fingernail clippings, and dead rats. The cringeworthy stories of working in the rundown building that's home to New York City's top prosecutor.
And what's being called the Chicago Cubs' Circle of Trust.
Most baseball clubhouses, basically everyone I've ever been in, are a rectangle of some kind or a square, some four-cornered room. The Cubs went a total different direction and built a relatively small, intimate circle.
Wall Street Journal baseball writer Jared Diamond on the unique clubhouse design for the reigning World Series champs. He's here in about 20 minutes. Well, Donald Trump won North Carolina and its 15 electoral votes by claiming seven rural counties that had voted for Barack Obama in 2012. Among them was Robeson County, the state's largest and one of its poorest and most violent. An easy explanation of the transition from blue to red focuses on economic stagnation and cultural despair. But from another vantage point, Mr. Trump's five-point victory had more to do with his ability to tap into the same desire for hope and change that Mr. Obama retained in an 18-point victory 4 years earlier. It's a story by Daniel Ullett, deputy commentator at the Washington Examiner, deputy commentary editor, I should say. Daniel, what did you find there?
Well, we are down in Robeson County, North Carolina, and that's a county that is very poor. It's very, they lost a lot of manufacturing jobs over the last 10 or 20 years due to NAFTA and other free trade agreements. And it's a traditionally Democratic county. They have, it's actually the most racially diverse rural county in America, 70% minority with a huge Native American population. So they've always leaned to the left, but after voting for Obama by 17 points in 2012, they actually swung to Trump and Trump won the county by 5%. So, he was able to do so for a variety of reasons, but we actually went around and asked people to try and sum up in one word why they thought Trump won in the county. And we heard a lot of different things like jobs and the economy, but the two words that we heard over and over again and most often were hope and change, which are, of course, the words, the mantra that Obama used to win the presidency back in 2008.
Yeah. What do they hope for, or what do they expect to change?
Well, the big thing is a return of manufacturing to the county. So they lost, 10,000 manufacturing jobs after NAFTA. A word that we heard over and again about NAFTA was devastated. It devastated the community. They have a household GDP, I think half the state average. And so you could say they're a bit desperate, which is probably true. But when he talked about renegotiating NAFTA, that really resonated with a lot of people there.
I know you point out there in Robeson County, it's not so much the diversity, but the pervasive poverty. Can you explain a little more about what's happening there?
Well, again, they've lost a lot of jobs. They also have a really bad education system. The schools aren't getting enough money. And they have a lot of violence and drug issues. They're right on the Highway 95 bisects the community, the county, and so a lot of people sort of were lamenting how drug traffickers were driving up and down 95, and how drugs have infected the community. So they have a lot of issues to deal with there.
Wow. What? Explain the situation with the guy you spoke to, that Mark Locklear, the Lumbee Native American, right? It was an Obama supporter, and then what?
Well, it's funny. We were talking to Mark. He's probably in his early 50s, and he was explaining how he had voted for President Obama twice, and he actually, as we spoke to him, he had a framed picture of the former First Family on his mantle behind him, a bobblehead of President Obama. And so he was still a fan. He didn't necessarily like some of the decisions on Obamacare and Obama's foreign policy. So he ended up voting for Donald Trump. Even though he still respects Obama, he said, look, we need to rethink healthcare, foreign policy direction. And so he was ready for a change. And it's funny because, of course, we know that many counties throughout the country that voted for Obama, I think there are 200 counties approximately, that voted for Obama twice for president, then flipped to Trump. And so you have millions of voters, and I think it makes sense then that they were looking for hope and change, because that's a similarity for, you know, what Obama was preaching, and then Trump as well.
We're speaking with Daniel Allitt, deputy commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. He's got a piece entitled How Donald Trump Sees the Mantle of Hope and Change. How much time is somebody like Mark Locklear giving to Mr. Trump to get stuff done?
I think longer than a lot of people in the media and a lot of people on the left would think.
Okay.
A lot of people in the Washington media are saying, oh, I can't, you know, I think there was a poll that came out recently that said only 2% of Trump voters would change their vote if they could.
Yeah.
And that was sort of shocking to a lot of people in the media, because obviously he's done so much wrong already. And I think people generally are going to give their politicians a while, maybe to the midterms. Obviously it will be the first sort of measure of how Trump is doing. But so I think the stuff that really gets the D.C. media up in arms, and we're paying attention to every tweet, to, you know, the palace intrigue of the White House, who's up and who's down, every small scandal. Most people they hear about these things, but it's not something that affects their daily life. And they're going to step back in 2 years, and obviously in 3.5, and think, okay, do I have a job? My kids have a good education, how's my health care, and then they'll make their decision at that point.
That's Daniel Allitt, deputy commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. It's Small Business Month, and Dell is celebrating innovators and job creators in a big way, like up to 40% off business PCs big. Even a free 1 terabyte external hard drive with select purchases big. Call 877-BUY-DELL today to connect with a U.S.-based advisor. They're ready to help with tech solutions tailored to your business, like finding just the right Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, because your hard work is more than appreciated, it's admired. Call 877-BUY-DELL today. Glad you're with us. How about this stat? Over 4 million Americans are using anabolic steroids, including 7% of high school students. Another surprise, most users are non-athletes, with men ages 15 to 34 the most likely, while use among men in their late 30s and women is emerging as well. What's being done? Here's Don Hooten, founder and executive chair of the Taylor Hooten Foundation, a group he founded after he lost his youngest son to suicide attributed to steroid use. Don, start with the basics here. What are anabolic steroids?
Gordon, anabolic steroids are quite simply various forms of artificial testosterone. They were developed for a great number of legitimate medical reasons. They're very, very powerful and effective drugs, but I think, as all of our listeners know, they've been used for a lot more than fixing illnesses. They're used by bodybuilders and athletes, and today our kids, to build muscle and to get bigger and faster and stronger, as we've all read about.
Yeah. All right. So I know this was referenced as a major unrecognized public health problem. Explain how, Don.
Well, up until now, almost everyone just assumes that this has been a problem with professional athletes. But what's gone unnoticed by the general public is this problem moved, as you might suspect, from the professional athlete athletic facilities down to the colleges and the high schools. And what's happened as it's moved into the colleges and the high schools is it's come out of the locker room. And what I mean by that is, if you just think about it, you got a group of guys that are working out, they've gotten all buff looking, and the girls have taken notice. And, you know, the athletes, you know, not only effective on the athletic field, but in a social environment. And what's happened is the other boys in school, many of them are now turning to anabolic steroids, just like the athletes do, to get that buffed athletic look. And, Gordon, today the experts estimate that 80% of the users of anabolic steroids are not athletes at all. They're simply doing it to improve their body image.
Wow. All right, so along those lines, are girls taking this stuff too?
Girls are taking this stuff too. There are, you know, some of the steroids make you bigger. Others do what they call cut muscle and make them more defined.
Wow.
And the girls are using these to get that six-pack, or as I've been corrected, four-pack look in their abs. You don't have to do quite as many sit-ups if you use some of these drugs. But they're, you know, just imagine our little girls making a decision to inject themselves with male hormones. I mean, yeah. It's crazy.
What are the dangers, Don?
Well, there are many, and they fall into both physical and emotional changes. On a physical side, I asked the thought question, does anyone believe that when you inject yourself with a muscle-building substance, the only muscles that are getting bigger are the ones you can see on the outside? To which the answer to that is obvious. No, all of your muscles are getting bigger. The most important one is your heart, and it gets weaker as it gets stronger. It doesn't get stronger. So, you know, the result is lots of different types of cardiovascular problems, including high blood pressure, increased risk of stroke. Overall life expectancy is shortened. And there's similar things to the liver and the kidneys, but also to the brain. These are hormones. Just think about it. They cause our youngsters to go through puberty. They get mood swings. Well, you take excess amounts of testosterone, and those mood swings accelerate. We've even got a name on the aggressive side. We jokingly call it roid rage. Well, it's real, and it's not a joke. And on the opposite side of the mood swing is severe depression, and that's what we experienced with our son Taylor. That depression can be serious enough to cause these users to think about, and in Taylor's case, commit suicide.
Jeez. We're speaking with Don Hooten. He's founder and executive chairman of the Taylor Hooten Foundation. We're talking about teen use of anabolic steroids. So based on your work here, what's being done, say, at the high school level? I mean, I know there's, you know, kind of random drug testing in certain states or perhaps school districts. Is there a more broader approach to this?
Gordon, sad to say, there's not. So what we're trying to push for is education in the schools. That's what our foundation does. We travel the country speaking to kids and adults about the problem. And education is sorely lacking. 85% of our children report they've never had an adult, a coach, a teacher, a parent talk with them about why they shouldn't be getting involved with these drugs. And we've just come out of a conference in Washington, meeting with government officials, and we're hoping to change that. But very little is being done nationally, and our federal government is doing, I'm sad to say, virtually nothing to address this problem.
Thanks, Don. Don Hooten, founder and executive chair of the Taylor Hooten Foundation. It's 23 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
See, if I can't trust you, Greg, then I have no choice but to put you right back outside the circle. And once you're out, you're out. There's no coming back.
Well, I would definitely like to stay inside the circle.
The Chicago Cubs, defending World Series champs, might have an advantage over clubs when it comes to chemistry, especially how they foster it. One way, a clubhouse with a round design, which encourages players to talk to each other. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you want to improve collaboration in a room, eliminate the corners where people can hide. That's the approach taken by the Chicago Cubs, and it seems to be working. Jared Diamond of the Wall Street Journal joins us now to talk about the design of the Wrigley Fieldhouse's new clubhouse. Jared, describe what this looks like.
Well, the most baseball clubhouses, basically everyone I've ever been in, are a rectangle of some kind or a square, some four-cornered room. The Cubs went a total different direction and built a relatively small, intimate circle with sort of a common space in the middle and all the lockers around the outside in a ring. They did this because they thought it would promote team unity. It's a baseball clubhouse where the players actually have to talk, which in baseball is pretty unusual.
When they were looking to design this clubhouse, where did they look and what were they looking for?
Well, they did go tour, you know, a lot of the other active major league clubhouses, which is common when you're building something new. Other teams will let you into their stadiums and sort of just check it out. And one thing that they immediately learned from those visits is that most clubhouses are too big. They're too spacious, that teams have valued giving players luxury and just ample space over intimacy to their detriment. So they immediately said, we're going to not necessarily build the largest locker room space. We want to make sure our players are actually near each other. They're not so separated. I talked to one Cubs player who used to play for the Dodgers, who built a new clubhouse about 3-4 years ago. And he said, sometimes it felt like you were 100 yards away from some of your teammates because it was just this large rectangular space. And that's how they came up with the circle. They consulted some studies that talked about the downside of having corners, sort of visual intrusions that stop players from being able to see each other. And they realized in a circle, everybody could see everybody, and players will be forced to just walk around and end up having these encounters with people that they might not otherwise.
Jared, do the players like it?
I think most of them do. It's certainly something different. You know, in baseball, chemistry is very much a chicken and an egg situation. It's always what comes first. Does the chemistry breed success, or does the success breed chemistry? And it's really hard to know, and there's probably no right answer. But the Cubs did just win the World Series, and they did this with a organizational philosophy that valued things like chemistry, things like character. It's something that the Cubs believed would give them an advantage if they valued this more than their peers. They're a very progressive organization, and it's very hard to argue with the results.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for joining us on this Memorial Day weekend, final weekend in May. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. Preparing for the rise of the machines. Also, brides are ditching bouquets this wedding season in favor of something else. We'll explain. And the really gross items that lawyers are likely to encounter in the office of New York City's top prosecutor. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, among the many horrors of the latest UK terror attack is the reality that the things kids love to do will naturally be things terrorists want to target, like concerts. Kids crave energy and activity, right? They also crave freedom from us, their parents, the rational ones, who tell them not to eat too much junk, stay up too late, or drink before they're ready to handle it. Jenny Anderson, senior reporter at the news website Quartz, has a look at what we can teach our kids and what they can teach us about terror attacks. Jenny, what can we do?
Well, I think what we need to do is frame the conversation. The truth is, with kids, if we don't, they will. And so they'll go to school. And even if they're really young, you know, 5 or 6, they're in their first years of school or even at preschool, you know, someone will have an older sister or brother, someone will say something, and without any context, they can do anything they want with information about a terrorist attack. So I think it's important to really just frame the conversation, start with an open-ended question, figure out what they know, and then try to, you know, offer them some reassurance. They are safe. There are people around them to keep them safe. This is a tiny minority of people, but, yep, there are some bad things that are going on in the world.
I thought it was interesting, too. One expert you talked to said validate their feelings. Don't tell them there's no reason to be scared.
And that's something I think we do a lot as parents, and I do it all the time. So I'm very sympathetic to this. But
yeah.
you know, we say, don't worry, there's nothing to be afraid of. This will never happen to you. It's almost like telling someone who has cancer, oh, I know you're going to be okay. Well, you don't know, and we don't know that. And, of course, we want to reassure our kids and make them feel safe. But the easy way out of that is just to say, you know, I get scared, too. Tell me what scares you. What is it about this that scares you? It's okay to be scared, but let's talk about how we are safe, you know. So okay. Don't go overboard in terms of saying how safe they are or how much we can control when we really can't.
Is there too young of an age to discuss it?
Oh, probably. I mean, you know, 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds, they don't need to know. I mean, even I found myself with my younger one this morning skipping over it. I think I'll probably have to come back to it later because she has older siblings and yeah. It will probably come up. So, you know, I'm not a child psychologist. You know, for some people, 5 and 6 will be too young. I think it's actually also very parent specific. I have plenty of friends and know plenty of people who will choose not to bring that up, to bring it up. And that's okay, too. There's no right or wrong answer. But my advice would be frame it before they frame it for you.
Very good. We're speaking with Jenny Anderson, senior reporter at Quartz. She's written a piece about what parents can learn from their kids and vice versa about living with terror attacks. So what about on the parent side? What is it that we might take away from watching our kids respond?
Well, I think a lot of kids will be understandably incredibly scared, but I also think teens in particular will be teens. They are developing a sense of freedom. They want to get out there. They want to do things. And parents' natural response to something like this might be to rein them in. I don't want you to go to the mall because the mall could be a target for terrorists. I don't want you to go to a concert. Concerts have been really, really popular destinations for terrorist attacks. The Bataclan in Paris, and now we have Manchester. As much as I empathize with that point of view, I don't think it's the right one. What we could learn from our kids is, you know, we have to live. We have to let them go. We have to let them explore within boundaries and with rules, and obviously not in any reckless way, but we don't really want to model for them that the response to this is to sort of batten down the hatches and hide in the house. Maybe we should take a page from them in just continuing to live. And, you know, in the sort of stated words of George W. Bush, you know, don't let the terrorists win. Let's get out there and show them that we value this way of life. We are an open society. We do support each other. We go out. We engage with each other. And we're not going to change that way just because of these attacks.
It's Jenny Anderson, senior reporter at the news website Quartz. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Get ready for the machines. All generations need to be prepared for a future of automation and artificial intelligence, but should also know how to function without an app for everything. So says tech analyst Rob Enderle, who joins us now. Rob, set this up.
Well, so I was at Dell EMC World earlier in the month, and one of the panels they had was put on by a futurist out of the Institute of the Future. Interesting organization, by the way. And they were talking about, you know, the coming changes with regard to robotics, autonomous machines, artificial intelligence, and the rest. And on the panel, they had a futurist, they had a CEO, and they had a woman that ran a company that was focused, if she was a millennial and was focused on the ideas and concepts that millennials have, what kind of drives them in the market. And the differences between the groups, between the futurist, the CEO, the millennial, were pretty amazing.
You know, I was surprised because in your piece you said the millennial on that panel was not really much of a subscriber that artificial intelligence will be a big player or will disrupt things, right?
Yeah, and not unusual. When we've had big waves, big technology waves and changes, the people that live in the present generally don't see them coming. And you would think the kids would get it, but she really didn't. And neither did the CEO, who runs a technology company. Hmm. The futurist did describe the kinds of very disruptive activities that are going to happen when a lot of the people we speak to won't be people anymore. They'll be computers, and we won't be able to tell the difference when we're no longer able to, you know, no longer driving our cars, when the trucks and stuff around us are all driven by computers, and where much of our interaction isn't with people, but with computers. And the And certainly he thought that was going to be a lot more disruptive. Well, neither of the others thought, because they've got experience with computers as they have existed, certainly not as they will exist. They kind of thought, well, these are like the voice response machines or the robocall machines we talk to today, and they really can't do much. But that's not the way that they're going to be doing tomorrow. Within 10 years, you won't be able to tell the difference between whether you're on a phone with a person or a computer. And the computer will typically be better informed and much more strongly connected to real data.
All right, so you talk about social disruption in the piece, too. And this one sentence I want to ask you about: advances don't happen at the same time worldwide. So what could that mean?
Well, so one thing that was very different between when you looked at an older audience versus a younger audience was the older audience is clearly going to have a problem grasping the change as it hits. The younger audience, as it hits, they tend to be much more adaptive. But the problem with the younger audience, and the young lady that ran the Millennial Company showcased this, is they may not be able to function where the technology isn't. So, for instance, she told a story where she was going to go to a hospital. She was sick, and she had to go to the hospital. The hospital was closed. So she went 2 days without doing anything because she didn't know what to do. There was no app that she could go to and say, okay, hospital closed, send me to another hospital. She had to wait until she was just sick enough, and then she called her mother, and her mother said, well, just go to another hospital. So it just kind of showcased the dependence on apps. And by the way, there was an app for that. She just didn't know about it. So not only are they dependent on apps, apparently they don't bother to look to see if there really is an app for that, if they're not using it. And it really raises up a significant concern about millennials being so dependent on technology they can't function without it. For instance, she didn't know what a payphone was. And yet there's still payphones in use in parts of the world where they haven't implemented wireless technology. That there, when we have autonomous cars, there will still be a lot of places in the world where somebody's going to have to drive.
Right, right.
And so you take somebody from that millennial generation that's now used to all this automation and all this technology, and you put them somewhere, they decide to go on a vacation, and they go someplace where none of it exists, they are going to be absolutely lost. I remember watching a woman who was from a very wealthy family, and they'd lost all their money, and she was all used to a chauffeur, and she went and she tried to rent a car, and then they get pulled the car out. She says, well, where's the driver?
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware. To learn more.
Thanks for being with us. New trend you might see if you're attending a wedding in the coming weeks or months, and it has to do with the bouquet that the bride is holding. Gigantic, earthy bridal arrangements are moving into the aisle, with some looking a bit more like assemblages of landscaping than traditional wedding decor. And Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Randazzo says these oversized bouquets definitely are not made for tossing. Sarah, what's this about?
So I have to say, the story came up in the course of planning my own wedding, which is later this year. I've got a little too deep on the wedding blogs and started noticing that bridal bouquets are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was trying to figure out what was going on here, and there's a few factors at play, but basically bigger is better these days, and brides have these huge elaborate bouquets that are having not just flowers, but even things like branches and vines, and in some cases, even fruits and vegetables.
And why is that?
So I really think it's being driven by this internet culture around weddings that's pretty intense these days, where brides are really into showing off their weddings when they're done, and wedding vendors are in it as well, where if you're a photographer or a florist, you want your work to stand out online so that you get more clients. And one way they do that is to just try to have photos that really pop and stand out. And so people have discovered that if you have just massive arrays of florals in the picture, it does stand out.
I'm looking at the picture that accompanied your story about this model. She's holding a 30-pound centerpiece.
Right.
I mean, it looks like she had just been through the yard and just picked up a bunch of stuff that she now needs to drop in the garbage can or composting bin. I don't get it.
Yeah, and that one was particularly funny because that photo was one that appeared on the internet, and it's this woman who looks like a bride holding this massive centerpiece, but it's actually a model who was doing a photo shoot, and so that wasn't meant to be a bridal bouquet. It was meant to be a table centerpiece, but the photographer said, hey, why don't you hold this just to make the shot even more dramatic? But after that photo came out, the florist who made it has now been getting calls from people saying, I want a bouquet just like that one in the photo. And she's like, well, that was 30 pounds. It was meant to sit on a table. And they're like, I don't care. I want that bouquet.
Jeez. So now I got to ask, is this something that that the bride then throws to the bridesmaids and they wrestle each other to try to catch?
Yeah, so that was one of my first questions, was what about the bridal tosses? And it turns out a lot of traditions are getting kind of thrown out these days in weddings, but so a lot of brides just don't throw bouquets anymore, but those who do now have to get a second bouquet made that's smaller, because if they threw these main ones, they would take someone's head out, so it would be way too dangerous.
Unbelievable. Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Randazzo. By the way, the headline for the story was very catchy. It says, brides are ditching bouquets for 13-pound clumps of vegetation. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Thanks for being with us. The next U.S. attorney in Manhattan will take over the most prestigious office of federal prosecutors in the country, famous for their aggressive pursuit of Wall Street titans, prominent politicians, and overseas hackers. The Wall Street Journal, though, says that person will also inherit an office with a history of bedbugs, lead-contaminated water, and other yucky stuff. That may be understating the situation, which goes beyond the worn carpets and dated computers typical of a government building. In the past decade, the workspace has suffered bedbug outbreaks and the occasional ant infestation. Brian Jacobs, who served as the office's deputy chief of appeals until 2015, once noticed a strange odor, only to later discover the source to be a dead rat decomposing in a radiator. One lawyer recalled moving to a new office and opening a drawer to find what he called an outrageous amount of mold. A colleague opened his drawer to find what happened to be about 10 years' worth of fingernail clippings. Acting U.S. Attorney June Kim, by the way, calls the office shabby chic without the chic. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.